Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 21, delivered on November 8, 2016. The title of this lecture is Portfolio Construction.
Tonight, Portfolio Construction. Fairly compact lecture. This is getting away from some of the brutally more difficult stuff that was in previous chapters, but this is also more practically useful to you in the long run. Start out with a basic question for you to ask yourself. Madam, you're going to make a lot of money, right? And you're going to have some money that you can put away and do investments, right? So that you have a nice pad so that you can retire and live in a very nice place near Cabo San Luca and all that kind of stuff, or not, you know. Okay, trailer park in Decatur. Okay, something good like that. Okay, double wide trailer. Okay, now, are you going to, as you invest money, are you going to do this on your own, or are you going to do this through a professional investment advisor? You're going to use a professional, okay. You, sir, are you going to do it on your own or are you going to do it through a professional?
Both.
No, one or the other.
Myself.
Yourself, okay. You, sir, a professional or on your own?
Professional.
Professional. Madam?
Professional.
Huh?
Oh,
like hell you are. I'll be dead 20 years from now. At least I hope I will. Getting tired of getting up every morning. Okay. What do you say? Professional or on your own? Okay. Now, most people that you talk to, and I ask this a lot in every class, most people will say a professional will do. We'll go with a professional. Now, here's the thing. I want to warn you about this. I caution you. There's nothing wrong with going through a professional, but here is some real advice from someone who does this, who did this. Okay. An investment advisor, a wealth manager, a financial planner, whatever you want to call them. My broker will give me my advice. I use a full-service broker, and he'll tell me what to invest in. Okay, I took my students up to a place in suburban Chicago. I won't mention the name of it. It was a memorable experience because I was stopped by one of the town cops in the ISU van because the two hoe handles in the back, clear in the back of the van, my students didn't have their seatbelts on. So the son of a bitch kept me there for an hour running wants and warrants on everyone in the van. But anyway, that's just a personal story that just irritates me, so I tell it. So we went to this fancy, very nice place, and we were given a tour. It was like an investment house, except it's a little different from what you might think of as an investment house. What this place does is it creates financial products. In other words, packages of securities, combinations of securities, stocks, bonds, for different needs, different purposes, different betas, different this, that, and the other thing. Now, here's how it works. Okay. I am basically an investment advisor, and you want my advice. You pay me for advice. Now, what I'm going to do is these guys who build these products, these financial products, talk to me because they want me to use their products to sell to you. So they're going to do whatever they need to get me to use these products for you to buy. So they're going to buy me Chivas Regal. They're going to buy me steaks when they come into town. They're going to buy me tickets to the Sox or to something like that. They're going to take care of me because they know that if I use their products, then they make money just like I make money. But you understand that you're going to dump me if I lose money, obviously. But you also remember that thing I talked to you about, the agency relationship, the agency dilemma. This is where it is writ large, is because my view of what is right for you is tainted by these people who take care of me and want me to use their financial products. Because what I'm going to represent to you is that I'm busting my ass every day on your behalf. I work for you. Aren't you glad for that? But I don't really. I kind of do. I mean, your agent. I am there to maximize your welfare, but you got to understand that I am being affected by these processes you know nothing about here in the background. And it's not just one house. It's not just a couple of houses. It is the heavies from Wall Street to Los Angeles to Chicago to Austin. They are producing products, and they're marketing them to me to sell to you as the investment. I don't have to do a thing. I just sit back on my fat ass, and I sell you a product. I don't have to do any analysis of portfolio. I even need to understand portfolio control theory. All I need to know is the product going to work to keep you happy, to make you some money, make me money, make them money? You understand? That's the problem. You see, and you might say, well, isn't there fiduciary duty? Because I, as your agent, I should be in a fiduciary relationship with you. Trust, honor, and fidelity. You cannot know. You are the principal, but in this, and it's your job to monitor and enforce, but in this case, you can't monitor and enforce because you don't know enough to monitor and enforce. But unfortunately, that's not true because you know damn well you do know enough. You were a business major, you took a finance class, and you took it from the best professors that ever walked the planet. Okay? So you don't have an excuse. If I screw you over, if I use you to make money for myself in a way that is inappropriate, you don't know it, but you should know it because you are trained to know how to handle your own portfolio. That doesn't mean you should do it on your own, but that means that you should take an active interest, and you shouldn't just let them send you all these impressive papers. Oh, believe me, every couple of months, they're going to send you all these papers showing you the charts and these incredible performance numbers and these reports for you to be impressed by what they're doing for you. Believe me, they're going to do that. And it's up to you to decide whether or not that really is as good as you could do. That's the cautionary tale that begins this story. Now, where does the story go from there? It goes to the question of portfolio control. Portfolio control is really simple in a way. It starts with, like I said, this isn't some of that killer stuff with internal rates of return and that kind of bond pricing. This is somewhat simpler. Look, suppose that I have a securities portfolio, stock A and stock B. Purchase price. Okay, now, number of shares. So let's say that stock A in your portfolio, you're going to do a two portfolio stock, and don't ever do just two stocks in a portfolio. I've talked to you about that. Purchase price for stock A is, let's say, $25 per share. Purchase price for B, let's say, was $30. No, let's do $35 per share. I'll probably be sorry because these won't be even numbers. Now, number of shares. We're going to buy. Which should I buy? 40 shares or 100 shares?
100.
Exactly. Why?
The more the better.
No. Well, that's always true, except for that booze I had that time. No, that was. But no, it's a round lot. Remember, round lots, if you buy in an odd lot, it's not as good as if you buy in a round lot. Okay, so number of shares is 100. You're going to put 100 shares of each into your portfolio. Okay. Value of position. This is the value of the component positions. Okay, so that would be $2,500. And that would be $3,500. Oops. So your total is going to be, 25 and 35, $6,000. Okay? So that's your portfolio value starting off, $6,000. First thing recognized right off the bat is that it's not going to stay there. The prices will move on you. So your portfolio is going to be like a jiggly mass. It's going to sometimes sag on one side and rise on the other, sag on both sides, rise on both sides, something like that. Okay, so now, weight. Component weight is going to be for stock A, $2,500 of the $6,000. And for stock B, it's going to be $3,500 of the $6,000. Okay? Good Lord. I should be able to do this without a calculator. It's so sad. Okay, app. Where's my calculator? Okay, so I'm going to do 2,500 divided by 6,000. 41.67%. And then 59.33%. Now, if you add those up, of course, you get the weight of the entire portfolio, which is 100%. Okay. These are the weights of the components in the portfolio. Again, though, recognize that stocks will rise and fall against each other, which means that your weights in the portfolio will change. Now, let's go back here and put in beta. Let's say that the beta of security A is 1.1, the beta of security B is 1.6. Now we can do the beta of the portfolio. The beta of the portfolio is going to simply be 1.1. Wait, I'm sorry. Let me do it this way. 41.67% times 1.1 plus 59.33% times 1.6. So your beta of your portfolio times 1.1 plus 0.51. Is it 58? I was just testing you. Let's try it. 41.67 times 1.1 plus 58.33 times 1.6 is 1.39. I think that's right. The beta of the portfolio is 1.39. And it doesn't matter how many stocks are in it, just do it this way. However, again, I can't emphasize enough, as these prices change relative to each other, the beta of your portfolio is going to change as well. So that means, notice that that can actually have an adverse effect because you target a beta. You're looking for a beta for your portfolio based upon your risk tolerance level, where you are in your life, what your personal needs are, and all that kind of stuff. So what can happen is that, especially as the betas are spread out more, you can have the beta of the portfolio can turn rather bad on you. So in this case, if A goes up really solidly, but B doesn't perform so well, what that's going to ultimately do is cause the portfolio, the risk of the portfolio, to reduce, move toward the beta of 1.1 if A rises relative to B. On the other hand, If B rises relative to A, which is not that unusual to occur because, after all, it is a higher risk, higher expected return stock, by that, the nature of that, your portfolio beta will have a tendency to drift upward through time. Let me emphasize that again. What I'm trying to point out here is stock B here is a higher risk stock. The higher the risk, the higher the expected return. Okay, this is non-diversifiable risk. That's all beta measures. It's non-diversifiable risk. So this is risk that is inherent to the portfolio. And that means that B, stock B, probably will go up relative to A. A is a more defensive stock. It's still a pretty aggressive stock at 1.1. But anyway, one more of that. So this portfolio will tend through time to have B outperform A. And therefore, the weight of B in the portfolio, the portfolio's total value, will tend to move up through time. And that means that's where portfolio adjustment will come in. Again, you don't have to do this all the time. Not every day, every week, every month, maybe every year. Just keep an eye on your weights of each component. Like, for example, and I don't know if I said this last class or not, but I used to keep four mutual funds as my portfolio. Each one was diversified, and then I had weights of the different mutual funds that were anywhere from actually about 1.2 on up to one that was a 1.8. And I ignored the portfolio for a couple of years. And of course, surprise, surprise, not at all surprise, that mutual fund that had the beta of 1.8, it was doing really well. So whereas when I started, I had a beta of the whole portfolio that was weighted toward the lower risk mutual funds, so I had a total overall portfolio beta of about 1.25. By the time I looked at it again, the portfolio beta had drifted clear up to 1.55, about 1.55, because the high beta mutual fund was doing really well and it was beginning to overwhelm the values of the other things. So what I had to do was during the window after I found it, I simply sold off some of the mutual fund that had the high portfolio beta and moved that into, essentially skim the cream off it and move it into the lower beta portfolio to rebalance the portfolio. That's what we mean by portfolio control. And it's not difficult, but it's something that you do have to do. Whether or not you have a financial planner, or whether you have a financial planner, or if you're doing it on your own, either way, keep an eye on your own portfolio. Okay, now, as I told you, well, obviously, two stocks is not going to be nearly good enough to create portfolio diversification. You should have more. Now, when I throw out a number like you should have 30 stocks in your portfolio or something like that, well, I have to qualify that. These should be stocks that are not correlated with each other, okay? May I have your hand for just a moment, sir? Up here. Now, I want you to take my arm. Okay, now, we go this way. Now we go this way. Do you notice how much volatility there is? Da, 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 da. We're not helping each other stay on point. Now, take it again. When I go this way, you go that way. He got muscled. He just ripped me over there. Okay. You see, what's happening now is that we're not perfectly correlated, so we're staying more on the point. You see? Later, dinner. Thank you very much for that humiliating doing that. No, the point I'm trying to make here is that you see, you don't want the correlation to be too high between two stocks because then they are not canceling out each other's peculiarities. When you work for a small company, individual personalities dominate that company. That's where the creative power comes from. It's also where the ugly part and the great capacity for the company to collapse because of the internal strife happens. You work for a large company, which most of you will, you will find out that your peculiarities are being dampened down by the mass of the employees, by the policies and procedures, by the operating environment itself. You won't do all the crazy and wild things that you would have done if you had been a loner or if you'd been in a little group with your friends. This is the same way with stocks, is that as you gather more, the one thing you want to do is make sure that there are plenty. But you also want to make sure that they don't correlate with each other too well. Because if they do correlate with each other too well, then you're not achieving that elimination of unsystematic risk. Remember I told you that risk has two pieces to it. There is on this side the diversifiable risk, the risk that you can get rid of. We also call this non-systematic risk, because it's not in the system, it's peculiar to the individual stock. You don't want that risk, because that risk is not going to get you any kind of a reward. On the other hand, the other kind of risk is what is called non-diversifiable. You cannot get rid of it. It is the risk for which you should expect a reward. We call this systematic risk because it is in the system itself. It's what we get our rewards for taking. So the deal here is, though, that when stocks are too well correlated with each other, they're not canceling each other's movement. Like when we were doing this, we could move a lot farther away from the main point here. But if we were doing things in opposite directions, or not at least doing things at the same time, that's when you get the diversification, the portfolio diversification. I know very well that you're going to get sick. I'm going to get sick. So there's going to be correlation, but I know you're going to get sick probably at a different time from what I do. You probably will get sick in a more severe or less severe fashion than I will, and in a different time. That means that we have a low correlation. But if you and I were, and everyone in here, got sick about at the same time, that would be a problem. This is also, we had an interesting conversation about this in this business forum. We were talking about diversity in the workplace. And, you know, you had the old timers, well, it's just a fad. You know, yeah, we'll do it because it's a law, but, you know, we really don't. But then we had some brighter people, and I was speaking on their behalf defending them, who said, this is diversification. Diversity is where things that aren't alike come together to cancel out each other's peculiarities, just like in stocks. And just like in insurance, in health insurance, just like when you have that diversity, that gets rid of the peculiarities of any given group within the company. And it actually plays to the advantage, the long-term structural advantage, the human capital infrastructure of a company is strengthened if everyone isn't acting alike, doesn't have the same background, the same ethnicity, the same religion, and all that kind of stuff, the same orientation sexually. It was a fascinating conversation because we got everyone in there agrees, yeah, portfolio diversification, low correlation, and then they began to get this idea, that applies to the workplace as well. Very cool thing. Now, let me show you where I'm going with this. How do you find stocks? How do you find out stocks are highly correlated or not? Remember, our general metric is there are actually, interestingly enough, I don't know if they told you this in your stats class, but there are a couple of different correlation coefficients The one that is most popular is the Pearson correlation coefficient. There's another one called Spearman correlation coefficient. There are several out there. But Pearson is the one we usually use. Pearson is between 0 and 1. I shouldn't say that. Pearson can be negative. Two things can be negatively correlated. You don't want that really in a portfolio because then they cancel out each other's performance to a certain extent. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, those weights that we calculated over there, they can actually be used if you want to, it's kind of a silly way to do it, to calculate the overall return of a stock, because you can take the weight times the return to one stock plus the weight times the return to another stock, et cetera, through your portfolio, add them up, and you get the weighted average portfolio performance. But anyway, the correlation coefficient, you generally don't want that to be below 0 because then they'd be actually canceling out each other's strengths. But let me show you. This is one of those sites that's been around a long time, and I greatly respect these companies that do this because these are companies and people who manage these sites. They don't charge money. They don't have those stupid, annoying pop-ups and twitchy ads. They just offer you something that's useful to you. And it's really nice that they do that. And this is called the Portfolio Visualizer. Great site, and it's practical application you'll see here in a minute. So what I'd ask you is let's look at some stocks and see what their correlations are. Would they work in a portfolio together? So we'll do one, Alphabet, G-O-O-G. Anything else you want? Put something in there that would be related, but not completely related. Maybe AP. Is that APPL or APLL?
AAPL.
AA. That's the AAD. Okay. What else would you like in there?
GE.
Ooh. What else? What's Amazon's?
AMZN.
AMZN. Good. What else? NFLX, okay. Let me do a retail company. Let's do Walmart, WMT. What's Target's? And by the way, it's not Target, it's Target. Philistine. Let's do one, a war company, Halliburton. What's its trading symbol? Huh? Wait. I know Coke's is C-O-K-E. Pep. Okay. Oops. And we'll do Pep. Now, here's the cool thing. This is a correlation matrix. Now, it will be symmetric around the diagonal. The diagonal would be all ones on this, although I think they put dashes on this site. But then you'll see individual cross correlations. And I'm going to just, let me do 90-day just to get a real strong, and I'm just going to not ask for dates of analysis. Go. Okay, here we go. Oh, okay. Okay, now, below 0.3, good. Above 0.3, 0.32, you're getting into too much correlation. So Alphabet, which is Google against Apple, yeah, they're highly, GE, interestingly enough. Now, that doesn't make as much sense. Apple I could buy. GE is a little bit odd because GE is more of a physical industrial company, although it has a financial services division. Amazon, look at this. But then, oh, well, Alphabet against Netflix, they are not correlated. They would do well in a portfolio together. They're not well correlated. which kind of surprised you because they're both online enterprises. Walmart, nah, that's pretty good. Target, that's odd. It probably has more to do with the demographics of Target and Google, both more for the youngers, I don't know, I can't call it. Halliburton against Google is a weird one. Halliburton is a war company. It profits in wars. It is a parasite of the war, of war civilizations like the U.S. has. Pepsi, back down there somewhat, but still a little bit of correlation. This one, I'd have them in the same portfolio. But putting Halliburton, that's a little bit too rich for me. And then you go through and you look at some of these. That is so weird. Netflix really is not correlated with hardly any of these. Netflix, except for Amazon, a little bit. But you know, Netflix looks like a kind of company that would be good in almost any portfolio, at least of big dog companies. But working your way down the line, notice something like, for example, what did I want here? Look at GE. GE is the only company GE is not correlated with is Netflix. That explains a lot. GE is essentially so involved in so many different companies and so much an underlying substrate of other companies and what they do that it's going to be correlated quite strongly with most companies. In other words, and I am not giving you investment advice, for God's sake, but I would probably, for my own portfolios, I would avoid GE because its correlation, it just essentially is not doing a whole lot for portfolio diversification in any portfolio I'm looking at here. Now, I wanted to also look at Target. Target is actually highly, highly correlated with most of these companies. As a matter of fact, Target is really heavily correlated with Walmart. Whither goes Walmart, so goes Target, which is kind of creepy when you think about it. Target is highly correlated with Amazon. They are consumer companies, all of them. So when one gets pounded, the others get pounded. When one does well, the others do well as at the same time. So there's an interesting thing for you. Now PepsiCo, notice that PepsiCo is a little bit better against Google, against Apple, against Amazon, and even Netflix, of course, obviously, but even against Halliburton. PepsiCo actually looks like a stronger candidate for a portfolio where you're trying to get quick portfolio diversification. That's all there is to it. Now, the other side of it. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. Sooner or later, you've got to start thinking about your beta. Who are you as far as your beta goes? Not yet. It's okay for you to be have it as a mystery. But in the back of your mind, start formulating that sense of what is my beta when I'm 24, when I'm 28, when I'm 35, 40. So the next thing that we would want to do is say, all right, because my portfolio beta is a weighted average of the beta components, component betas, where can I find betas? Well, here's one place, right here on Yahoo, you can find your betas. Okay? That's kind of one by one going through. It's okay. That's, by the way, how I would do it. I would do it this way. But if you want a more summary way to look through, now, don't look at these current time-varying estimates. Look at the long averages, because if you're going to do investing, you should be doing on the long haul. Going through here, I want you to just look for a minute. First of all, focus on the companies that have high, high betas. What do you see? Let me call out some. AIG, Apache, Anadarko, Bank of America, Bank of New York Mellon, Citigroup, Caterpillar. Capital One. Ooh, Dow. Duh. Ford. Freeport MacMoran. I'll tell you what that is here in a minute. JP Morgan Chase. Call out at any time if you see anything. There are a couple of things that are standing out. A couple of industries are standing out. What's one industry that you notice has a tendency toward high betas? Yep, banking. Absolutely. Banking has turned into the bad boy. They just can't stop being a bunch of corrupt sons of bitches. I mean, they get their butts burned on one scandal after another. So what happens? There comes Wells Fargo with the latest one. It's sort of like serial idiots, they are. So the banking industry is going to be a high beta industry. Guess who's not going to get a grant from the banking industry? Well, you can kiss my butt. I don't need it. I need a good checking account. Okay, another one. Did you notice another one that seemed to have high betas I was calling out? Caterpillar. Ford, the heavy, the industrial heavies, they are having high betas now. They are in a period of flux. That thing, we're moving from an industrial economy to a service economy. Well, in a way we are, but it's more important. We're always going to have manufacturing. It's always going to be a hugely important thing. The technology of manufacturing is going to change greatly, and that's where the real problem is, that the technology of manufacturing, the power players in the manufacturing industry are in flux right now. One of those is Caterpillar. Caterpillar is a company that is having problems right now, serious problems. And I will cover this microphone up to say a little more about that, because we're in the Caterpillar auditorium right now. Caterpillar is a company that has been very good to us here. However, they are not happy with us here at Illinois State, at least not in the last few years, simply because we're on their A-list. In other words, they give us a lot of money. And in exchange, we recognize them by naming something after them, but we also make sure that we are delivering to them a constant flow of interns. And we are not doing it. We can't get too many people once they figure out what the problem is with an internship with Caterpillar. Do any of you know what the problem is? Say it?
It's unpaid.
They do now. They legally have to. Oh. There's something else. Caterpillar expects you to take off a full semester, spring or fall semester, to work for the company in their internship program. So that puts you behind at least a semester, and if it's a lockstep program, that puts you a year behind on graduating. They are all pissed off at us because we can't get students to dump graduating on time to do an internship with Caterpillar. But that's one of the things that's going on. Caterpillar is having a harder time, and also their reputation has been damaged. Years ago, Caterpillar... And I think I mentioned this already, and this is no secret. One of their executives talked to my finance students about this at a finance club meeting. She said, we were obsessed, focused on profit, 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 bottom line, bottom line. And that was essentially driving the company into the ground. The company was dying even as it was doing great on profit. Accounting numbers turn out to be numbers. Finally, it's maybe been about 6-8 years ago, Caterpillar and this lady who was one of the executives of Caterpillar said, we began to understand that it wasn't profit that mattered. It was free cash flow. How much actual money you had in your pocket. Not what it said on a piece of paper. It was free cash flow. What I've been bitching at you guys about in this class all semester is that cash flow, cash flow. Well, they began to turn their focus. But the problem is that essentially it was like a smoker. You can do all kinds of reform, but if you've been doing the wrong thing for too long, eventually you're going to suffer as a result of that. And that's what these companies, now more companies are beginning to grasp that cash flow is what matters, not profit. But so many of them spent so many years so obsessed with profit that they're going to have to go through a painful process of realigning their mentality, how they pay bills, how they collect money, how what products they sell. You could sell, man, you could sell, in my business, I could sell probably easily three times as much as I do if I sold it on credit to my customers. But I'd die. I'd have this massive profit, and I'd be paying tax on that profit, for God's sake, but I wouldn't have any cash flow because the people hadn't paid me yet. So that keeping that mentality straight, you start modestly, you try to keep cash flow moving, you'll do better. Now, industrial companies. You notice one down there, Freeport Macmoron. Do any of you know what Freeport Macmoron is? Where was that? Where was Freeport? Okay. Now, I first ran into Freeport Macmoron when I was in consulting. I ran into this company where it had begun, which was in Indonesia. I was in the process of working with a group of investors. We were trying to get a license to explore for copper on an island called Sulawesi. Indonesia is basically a thousand islands. Sulawesi is this weird kind of spiral-shaped island. And there was all kinds of corruption. We were paying all these different people for, you know, who were connected to the dictatorship. Suharto was a dictator there, and his relatives were in positions of power. We had to pay off all these people to get just a license to explore, a permit called a Kuasa Pertambangan. And basically the big 800-pound gorilla company that had been in Indonesia for over a century was Freeport Macmoron. Now, how Freeport Macmoron had started was in Indonesia. There was a mountain, literally a mountain that was made almost entirely of copper. And so Freeport started mining this mountain, and that's how they became a force in the world of metal mining. And what was cool was I actually was able to see. I didn't get too close, but I was given a tour of some of their facilities. The way they mine this mountain and other mountains like it is they block cut. They cut in at the base of the mountain, mine it out, and then they blast the mountain, the mountain drops. And then they cut through again, and then they blast it, and it drops again. So over a century, this mountain that used to be about twice, it was twice as high as it is now. Freeport Macmoron is a metals company. You look at companies that are involved in mining and metals, you're going to see high betas almost every last time because it's risky business. Metals move up and down in price. Metals require a heavy industrial base. There's nothing light about metals, the metals mining. It's some of the biggest, most monstrous equipment you will ever imagine. Another industry where you see a lot of industrial equipment is companies involved in wood and paper products. The scale of the things that they use. Literally a machine I saw that was about 200 feet wide that just drove through a forest bringing trees down. It just literally turned them into flinders as it moved through a rainforest. Awesome and tragic. But at the same time, as far as investment's concerned, you want high betas, look for industrial companies. Companies like Dow. Look at that size of that beta. By the way, you should be getting a sense of what a scary beta is. Look at a DuPont. Interestingly, Walt Disney is not, that beta on Walt Disney, that's higher than it used to be. Why is Walt Disney's beta higher than it used to be? I mean, it's still a mouse. Huh? To what?
TV.
And, well, they were always on TV. Oh, you're old enough. You remember on Sunday night, you know, that the Tinkerbell would twing, and you know, this thing would go over the Disney. Yeah. Huh? What?
Theme park expansion.
Theme park? What else? Do you remember... You gotta be old enough to remember, you have failed me for the last time. And now it's a Mickey Mouse. You failed me for the last time! Yes. They have gone into heavy duty, really serious, mainstream, sci-fi, spend the money on the CGI effects production of movies. That profiles a risk upward. There are also other factors that are playing in too. One of the problems with big, heavy industrial companies, and Disney is an industrial company in its own way. Entertainment is industrial. You don't believe me? You get into entertainment, especially in the world of music. And it's like an industrial operation, getting that band up there on stage and the pyrotechnics and the acoustics and the lights, the audio, the visual. It's just awesome. But anyway, a lot of companies are getting away from the coasts. They're moving. Some companies can't. Whether you think that global climate change is human-created or caused by the planet's natural cycles of ice ages and warming periods, there are very few companies that have their heads in the sand. They know it's happening, and they're getting away from the coasts because the coasts are going to flood. They are already flooding. Nikon was nearly wiped out as a company because it had a major manufacturing operation on the coast in Thailand. And it one tsunami, and it was all gone. And they had to rebuild from scratch. Think about a company like Disney. Where are its theme parks? Yeah. You cannot pick up a theme park and move it. It's there. And so, as the sea levels rise in Florida and in California, eventually it's not going to be, welcome to Disney World, it's going to be, the mouse will drown. Okay? I always wondered, did George Lucas actually know that he was going to sell it to Disney? I mean, think of Princess Leia. She had Minnie Mouse ears. Anyway, that's conspiracy theory. Know your beta. Know yourself. And go to a beta screener. Go to the correl and look for betas that are you're comfortable with, and then feed those into the correlation screener and build your portfolio. Or, if you're having a professional do it, you still have a responsibility to go through and analyze his investments. And if you are ever told by a financial advisor, well, the internal components of this are really complex and I really can't show those to you, you dump him faster than you would dump Harley Quinn, okay? Because that is one crazy liar to you. Don't ever have your portfolio opaque. Transparency so that even if you didn't build it, you can see how the engine works at its very basic component level. Now, that's all I have for you. I have a quiz to give you, and then you finish that quiz, and that's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.